Education and General Government Committee, and I need a much better notepad than that. Thank you. I apologize for the delay. I was meeting with some college students from Oregon Student Association outside the door. And I also had a meeting with the a couple of folks, the chair and the vice chair of the Oregon State Board of Education, and we actually talked a little bit about foreign language. So I asked them to make sure to listen in to the hearing today when they have a moment so they can learn about this important issue. So we have two informational hearings today. We have foreign language and then pre-need trust funds. We're going to take the foreign language issue first, correct? And I think I also need to remind people, if you've not been to my committee before, we have rules here, and the one rule is turn off your cell phone, please. All cell phones, PDAs, anything that makes a beep noise, any kind, please turn it off. Otherwise, we'll be asking you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. So, with that, I'm going to open the informational hearing on foreign language education, and I actually want to hear from the department first because I want them to set the table and tell us where we are with our requirements and where we should be. So, Salam, and who have you got with you?
Rindy.
Okay. And I understand Senator Morse is sick today. He's been struggling. You were just writing me a note. He's been hanging out with us as much as possible, but he is very sick and going home, and Senator Metzger will be here shortly. But you have our undivided attention as the Three Musketeers.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent for the Oregon Department of Education. And with me is Randy Jantz, our Foreign Languages Education Specialist. We appreciate your interest in foreign language instruction and certainly appreciate the opportunity to share information with you about the role the Department of Education plays in supporting foreign language instruction statewide. And I'm hoping that my comments will provide you some context that Brendy will build on in terms of what we specifically do to support foreign language instruction at a state level, and also it may actually provide some context for other presenters and other testimony that you will receive on the topic. My portion of the presentation will be brief, highlighting current requirements for students to meet the state graduation requirements in the area of foreign languages. And Randy will build on that and tell you exactly what we do to support foreign language instruction and some of the programs and activities we are currently involved in to help build capacity for expanding opportunities for students statewide, taking into consideration that this is an area of growing interest in the state, and that there are new opportunities that are available for students. We have been approached relative to Chinese, for example, or what's often been referred to as critical languages, such as Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Arabic, Russian. And we're delighted to see that interest, actually, in the state. And it's not presented to us by the education community alone. There is a great deal of interest from the business community, and that began to see foreign language or world language acquisition as a critical economic and workforce development need in our state. Currently, students have to complete one credit in foreign languages to graduate from high school. Most students, however, complete at least two credits to satisfy the Oregon University requirements, admission requirements. However, the Oregon University system will often accept students that have not completed the two credits in high school with the understanding that they will complete two terms of a college-level second language course with a grade of C- and above. So they're willing.
Stop, Mr. Noor, because is a credit a year-long course?
Yeah.
So you have to take a year-long course to get a credit.
Yeah, Madam Chair, okay. At the high school level, it is a year-long course.
That's what I was
wondering. Yes, and it equates to one term at the university level.
Okay.
Yep. And that is consisting of 130 hours of seat time, traditionally. However, starting in 2012, and based on State Board adopted new diploma requirements in January of 2007, students will have the option to complete up to three credits in a foreign language. And I would like to draw your attention to the handout that describes the new diploma requirement. I believe it's the second page, and this may be familiar to you. At least I hope it is, and I understand we've shared this information with you in the past, and I believe you've had, as you mentioned, Chair Walker, that you've had conversations with the board chair and vice chair on this. So if I may draw your attention to the table on the bottom of the page, and the section that says second language arts and current technical education, currently students are required to meet one credit in this area, and it can be in any of these categories. And some students elect to meet that requirement in second languages or the arts or current technical education. By 2012, that option has been expanded to accommodate admission requirements of the university system and also taken into consideration that students need to be proficient in multiple languages, and we want to expand those options and opportunities for them while in high school, given the globalization that we're experiencing and also the economic competitiveness that students gain for being fluent in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see that in our local communities, where many jobs actually require students to have proficiency in English and Spanish or Russian or Vietnamese, for that matter. So students now can take up to 3 credits in a foreign language or a combination of 3 credits in these areas. So they're not required to take...
Right.
Foreign
language.
Foreign language.
They could take 3 credits of art, 3 credits of career technical education, and only have to graduate still with 1 credit of foreign language, correct?
Or none.
Oh, my God.
Yes. So, and the board decided to expand that category and expand the option but not require it, taking into consideration some of the capacity issues and the challenges that we have in our small and rural schools in particular. But nowadays, there are lots of different options and avenues for students to pursue foreign language acquisition, and much of it can be done online and through distance learning, et cetera. So the option has been expanded, and there's a lot of support from the Board of Education for foreign language acquisition in our state. In fact, the board's discussion focused on making foreign languages available at a much earlier stage in the educational continuum and not waiting until high school for students to take the 3 units should they choose to complete 3 units or 1 or 2.
And you're exactly right, Mr. Moore, because that's a conversation we just had, that
yes.
We should really try to focus that on the earlier grades.
That's right. That's right, Madam Chair. I think that would be a much more effective approach, but then there are some resources and capacity issues associated with
okay.
that.
Well, I can tell you right now, I don't want this. I just don't want foreign language to slip through the cracks, because leaving it as an option mm-hmm. means many kids won't take it.
Right.
And even though university system requires it, which is a good thing, but
yes.
how are they going to get it if it's not required
yes.
at the local level? Okay.
Absolutely. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Wendy to talk about some of the work that we're doing relative to foreign languages and the partnerships that are happening around the state to support that endeavor.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Before we get there, for example, if a kid took Spanish in grade 7 or 8, does that meet the requirement for the university system, or does it have to be in high school?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it depends on the level of the foreign language instruction that the student receives. If that level equates to high school course content, mm-hmm. then it may satisfy the Oregon University System requirements. And I think that's really the emphasis here, is that the level and the content is that of a full year or 2 years of high school second language.
Okay. One would assume that middle school curriculum is relatively close, I would think, as far as languages. That was my experience anyway, but that was a long time ago.
Not just a long time ago, a long time ago.
You didn't have to do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I believe you are right, and that may still be the case in some places.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. Let's move on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be following the first page of your handout.
After you state your name.
My name is Randy Chance with the Department of Education. I'm sorry. I'd like to begin with our first and primary responsibility in the second language area, which is the academic content standards. We are responsible to maintain those standards at a level that is matching the national standards, to review and revise them every 7 years. We do get the help of a content panel to do that, panel of teachers from around the state. And they, as they're reviewing the second language standards, consider national standards and standards from other states that we would like to model after. This most recent revision in 2005 did not result in very many changes in the standards themselves. However, we did add to the standards document a lot of background information and information that will help teachers to connect our standards to the national standards and support their instruction as they use our document. Another support we have in place to districts and to teachers is our second language website. The website contains a lot of information, and we've just recently updated the site itself. Teachers and administrators may access the second language standards to inform their instruction and their planning of the curriculum for a second language program. We've also identified assessments that are available throughout the state. Many of them have been created by university systems or school districts to assess their second language program because that is a local responsibility. We also identify publications and materials that are available to support teachers in their instruction and curriculum supplements. The site does identify professional development associations and organizations, both national and local associations, that would also be of assistance to districts and to schools. In addition to the second language standards and curriculum materials, we have begun partnerships with Mexico and other countries. Currently, our Oregon-Mexico Standards Alignment Project is to support mostly the migrant education population. We are aligning Oregon standards with the Mexican standards, which are national standards. And then after we've completed that alignment, we'll be aligning the materials that the country of Mexico provides to Oregon schools free of charge with those standards so teachers may access them more easily. The materials come in both online and in the form of textbooks. The Visiting Teachers Program is something we started in 2004. We signed a memorandum of understanding with the country of Spain. That memorandum resulted in a pilot year in which we brought four visiting teachers to the state of Oregon to teach in Oregon schools for a year. This year is our second year of the program. We currently have six teachers, three in Corvallis, two in Canby, and one in the Dalles, all teaching second language or teaching content in second language. We also have a memorandum with Japan. We bring one teacher over every 2 years to teach in an Oregon school. Our teacher this year is in Eugene, teaching at Hospert Elementary for 18 months. And we have a memorandum with Mexico to bring teachers to our summer migrant program. We bring 30 to 50 teachers a year to teach in our migrant education program for 4 to 6 weeks in the summer. We're expanding that program to include the school year and bring teachers over probably within the next 2 years. We are also meeting with representatives, or have met with representatives from Taiwan and China, exploring the possibilities of a cultural exchange program with both of those countries. The last two bullets are programs that the University of Oregon is heading up, but we have been involved in before we go on to those two, in your packet, we have provided you with the yellow sheet, K-12 Chinese Language Education in Oregon. I wanted to provide you with this information because it summarizes what's happening in Oregon now with language education, specifically in Chinese. It summarizes the programs that we are currently aware of, where they're located, the grade levels. And on the back, some information about private schools and heritage schools, community college and university programs. The last two sheets are information about the University of Oregon programs. The Chinese flagship has a goal to develop a national K-16 model language program to produce superior level Chinese speakers. And the roadmap is striving to create conditions that will allow Oregonians to graduate and be professionally proficient in English and functionally proficient in another language. This is the result of planning sessions, including representatives from the business and government and education communities, has really resulted in a timeline or a roadmap to become proficient for our citizens to become proficient by the year 2025.
Madam Chair, that uh-huh. concludes our segment of the presentation. We're happy to answer any questions. We're happy to provide you any information that you would like at this time or
okay.
come back and provide you additional information.
Let's see if the committee has any questions. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. I would like some information. I hadn't heard of this about your summer migrant education program, who you're targeting, what sort of curriculum you have, that sort of thing. If you could get that to me, it'd be helpful.
Okay, absolutely. Do you want to talk about that? Okay. We will certainly do that.
Okay, yeah, I had not heard of that program either, so I want to know a little bit about what you're doing there. Okay. Well, great. I want to hear from some folks who actually are foreign language teachers and involved and see if you're meeting their expectations and what they need from the department. So I would appreciate you hanging around, and we'll have you step back and bring some folks forward.
Be happy to do that. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay, Ann Mueller and Bob Wilner. Welcome. State your name. Choose whoever wants to go first.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bob Wilner, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council, a nonprofit organization established 20-some years ago to try to strengthen international education in Oregon. My background before that was in the United States Foreign Service, which persuaded me that the most serious problem our nation faces in the world is at home, with people who are insufficiently aware or accepting of the worldwide environment in which we are going to live for the next, as long as we survive. I think most of us agree the United States faces a major challenge in the world, most of us here anyway. With nations, many of them our size are much larger, exerting themselves to develop a body of highly educated citizens who can outcompete our citizens in economic and political and potentially military areas. We'll have a hard time keeping up, for instance, with giants like China and India, each with a billion or so people, not to mention the other late risers who are following their footsteps and are joining the competition. Countries whose education systems produce highly capable minorities, some of them more numerous than our entire population, that can outperform us dramatically. I think this is a serious wake-up call. What do we do about it? Recognizing we can't outnumber or squelch the competition, I think we can maintain a strong position in the world if, A, we emphasize that communication, peaceful competition and cooperation hold far more promise for the world than a zero-sum contest that some of us envision, and that we have to build on our existing talent base to bring ever larger proportions of our population to the peak of their capabilities so we can communicate and compete and cooperate. It's a very complicated process. No single answer is sufficient, except we have to be aware of the complexity. I think second language for every citizen is essential, first because it helps to make real the humanity of our planetary neighbors and to identify commonalities as well as differences among us. Concurrently, it enhances our ability to function in that global community and to recognize the risk of turning our back on the future. And one of the interesting reminders that comes out of the study of Chinese history is that in China, about 600 years ago, the rulers decided that they had nothing more to learn from the rest of the world, and they shut themselves off from it. And the result was pretty horrible. They missed out on the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution, and it took them 150 years to decide to turn around and try to catch up, which they're doing very well now. But I don't think we want to go through that process ourselves. But I think it's a real danger if we don't wake up. And my last point comes from my father's observations. I don't know if I've shared with them with this committee before. He was an accidental observer of the Russian Revolution as a war prisoner, Austrian war prisoner in Russia and Siberia, 1914 to 1920. I grew up on a lot of stories where he talked about some of the fine Russians he had known, and I asked him once, well, there were such fine people, why did it turn out so badly? His response, I think, is one we all need to remember. He said, the peaks were always as high as anywhere. The problem was that the average was so low. When there was a real crisis, the average Russian didn't know what to do, so they were glad to welcome somebody who came along with a plan, a guy named Lenin. So as a conclusion, I just say we can't sit back and relax. We have to get out and dig in a world-conscious and unstratified commitment to the future, involving our whole country, not just an elite. And language is one of the tools we'll need for that work. But I think it's a very important tool, but it's not the only one. It's part of the basket. And with which in mind, I'd like to proceed to introduce your next speaker, who I understand you're looking forward to hearing from on that subject, Ann Mueller. She's taught Spanish at all levels from elementary school through college. Her exceptional teaching effectiveness was perhaps best quantified. She's going to be embarrassed at this. In 1998, when she was teaching Spanish at Crescent Valley High School, her students took the National Spanish Exam, which is administered nationwide by the American Association of Teachers of Spanish. About 300-some Oregon students took that test. They published the honor grades and the teacher of the honor grades. Honor grades went to 26 statewide, of whom 13, including the top three, were Ann students. Mm-hmm. If you want to quantify teaching proficiency, I think that's it. She retired from her active teaching position after that, a few years after that, moved into a new career as a teacher of teachers, teaching language for proficiency, and she's made quite an impression doing that as well. And we have a letter I think I sent you. One of the programs she's involved in is a seminar each summer in Mexico for Spanish teachers to try to improve their language and teaching capabilities. We got a very moving encomium from the people in that a couple of years ago. A letter sent to OIC, which organized the program. We felt we had to make our shared admiration of Ann known to all of you and hope you'll consider it when planning future seminars. Her experience makes her a true expert, and her attentiveness to the participants as individuals and the diverse details of the program make the difference between a seminar that is satisfactory and one that is outstanding. So I think it's time that I shut up and turn the microphone over to Ann, because she has a lot to tell you about how foreign language can be taught and how not.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wilner. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. And Ms. Mueller, you're on.
Thank you. All right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, first of all, thank you very much for inviting us here. I am also the president of the Confederation in Oregon for Language Teachers, and I am partially representing them as well, and I'm hoping to be able to convey to you that people learning a second language is my passion, you know, and now that I'm out of the classroom, it really is, you know, I don't benefit from promoting it, but I really believe that we need to step up to the plate, so to speak, globally. The papers that I gave you was some research that we've all been saying this is why you should study a second language, and we found the research to back us up. And so what I'm going to do is give you a summary of what's on those pages, and then you can read it later if you so wish. And learning a second language is not just for the academia anymore. It is not just for conjugating verbs and for people coming up to me 15 years later and say, I had Spanish in high school and all I remember is albóndigas, you know, meatballs, right? From the audiolingual method, and I believe probably you all learned that way, okay? And so, you know, we in our field had to step up to the plate as well. We had to move beyond teaching to only the 5% of the students who loved grammar as much as we did. 95% of our students could really give a rip, you know. There are 5%, and we're no longer just training teachers. We are training people to take that language that they learn and go out into the world and apply it to their jobs. And it's really crucial that we do so, because there's an adage that says you can buy anything you want in English, but can you sell it?
So, Ms. Mueller, can I ask you to just sit back from the mic?
I hurting your ears? Okay.
Well, it just makes it real fuzzy, and these mics are very sensitive, so
okay.
You don't have to sit right up.
How's that?
There, that's much
all right,
better.
Good.
Thank you.
Now I'll take on
and
my
and that was
news
a great line.
Report. Yes. And so the reason for studying a language, I mean, it's not just the academic exercise that it used to be. Now the research is showing that it incorporates both sides of the brain. And so when you teach content-based instruction, learning concepts in both languages, it goes in for a deeper understanding and a long-term memory. Students also learn learning strategies that they can apply to other curricular areas. They are able to make contextualized guessing. They learn to increase their vocabulary and looking for roots. This helps their reading levels are higher, and the research is showing that among students who are not particularly academic gifted or students that have just been singled out because they're gifted at learning languages. This research was done on students who are average students, and it shows that the basic skill test scores increase among students even if you take time from teaching the basic skills to include the second language. Students have come out higher. We found this out in Portland anecdotally, that schools that were receiving the Ola Ola and the Moshi Moshi programs, when they took the basic skills test as compared to the schools that were not receiving these programs, the students at the schools that were receiving the programs came out higher in math and reading and writing. Students learn ways to communicate. Students, we, as teachers, have learned through the research to appeal to all of the ways that students learn. It's called multiple intelligences. Some of us are gifted mathematically. Some of us are gifted physically. Some of us are gifted at of the talk, okay? Some of us are gifted musically. And in our ways of teaching now, we need to include ways to appeal to all these different multiple intelligences so that students will buy into what we're trying to do. We don't want to be the class of the elite. We want, and we know, that we have to teach all students. About 10 years ago at Crescent Valley High School, when Everybody was supposed to have a language requirement, and that included our special needs students as well. Our principal took this commitment and gave me a classroom of 18 students who had all been identified on an individualized education plan. I had them 90 minutes a day for the entire school year. Took us till November to get to love each other. When the kids knew there was no way out, they couldn't just drop it, that they had to stay the whole year and they had to reach my academic standard, which at that time was a benchmark 3 on the Oregon standard. Of those 17 students that started, one was removed from the classroom because he threatened my life to the counselor. Okay. And there were 16 of them, and 13 of the 16 reached the benchmark. 7 of them continued and went on to the third year of language study. And we had one special, very special needs student who really wasn't communicating in either language, but he learned to say, "My name is Matthew. And this is my elbow, and this is my hair, and I'm 17 years old." I mean, so, you know, Matthew was very proud of the fact that he was mainstreamed into the classroom. So I think that that was, for him, a socialization effort. Along with learning a second language comes skills in teaching you how to memorize, how to remember things that aren't written down, because after age 10, research shows that once you become literate at age 10 and start writing things down to remember them, you tend not to use your listening skills to remember things. And this is highly evident in those of you who have children who are 6, 7, 8 years old who can remember their friends' telephone numbers, about 25 of them. Can you do that? You know, and then once the kids learn to copy it down, they lose practicing that memory skill. So that's part of why you need to learn a second language. And along with that, then, we're also looking at the idea that the kids will be looking for future jobs. And we all know that our job market of the future is going to involve being able to communicate in another language other than English. And it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be Chinese or Japanese. It's any second language. Studies have also shown that once you learn a second language, the third one becomes easier and faster because you have learned to use all these learning skills. And so someone who is trained in Spanish, maybe their company wants them to go to Portugal and they give them a very quick study in Portuguese. And so now you have a worker who can communicate in the financial connections with Portugal and Brazil. So we were looking for that kind of information. And so the problem that faces us now, and as we're looking, how do we accomplish this? Obviously, the earlier the student starts, the better. Mm-hmm. But if you quit after fifth grade and don't use that language, you lose it. You know, you have to keep it going. The other problem is, what do we do with our heritage speakers? And this is some of the programs, the flagship programs, the roadmap program, is really trying to involve those students who are already what we call half-baked. They're already speaking Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese, Spanish, Russian. They're already speaking that language at home to what we call the playground level, enough to take care of basic needs. And that takes, for non-native speakers, 3 to 4 years of study. And these kids are already there. So they may only be able to speak, and maybe they're not literate in their language, but you know, now we need to think about, how do we bring these kids into a classroom where we polish these skills the same way we keep our kids in English classes? They're native speakers of English, and they keep taking English to polish their skills. You know how an eighth grader writes compared to a 12th grader. We hope it's better. So, you know, we're looking at programs now. Let's make use of our heritage speakers in those languages that are less commonly taught languages, but they're also the languages that don't use the European alphabet, so it takes longer to get to a level. So we've got these Arabic kids and Vietnamese, Korean, Mandarin, Russian, Ukrainian. Let's do something with that and make use of it. These kids are American citizens, you know, and they deserve a chance to really enhance their job-seeking skills. So it's the language among the kids. It's also getting a well-trained teaching staff. So we have to focus on the language of the teacher, the language levels of the teacher. We have to focus on good teaching methodology, because through the years we have learned that there is a pedagogical method called teaching to functional proficiency that is more effective. It's second language acquisition, where we can take the same number of hours that students are exposed to language, and in the olden days you translate it and you conjugated verbs. And you read about Margarita's shirt, you know, and then somebody threw Don Quixote at you and said, read, you know. And so, you know, that was not a very efficient way of language learning. And now we have learned through 30 years of study what we need to do in our second language classroom to make use of every precious minute. And this needs to be programs that are continuous. And the standards set up by the Department of Ed, we're very happy with them. They've been our biggest promoters. And if you look through a well-articulated program that could go K through 16, we're looking at K through 5 if they turn those kids over to the middle school. And they're at benchmark 2 or 3. These are kids who can communicate in short sentences over very simple topics, and they can ask very simple questions, but they can, you know, get through the language in very simple ways. And we send them on to eighth grade and have this well-articulated program. We can send these kids to high school from sixth, seventh, eighth grade. We can send these kids to high school at either benchmark 4 or even benchmark 5, and that's the bridge. That's the border between non-communicative to communicative. At benchmark 5, students can start creating with the language and start trying to, if they don't know a word, they know a way to get around that. And so we send them to high school there and encourage the programs to keep them going, so that when they head for the university, they're maybe at benchmark 6 and benchmark 7. And then, after the university, we're going to get a workforce that is at the advanced level and above of communication. These are the people who can go anywhere in the world and work and travel and live in a second language. So the idea of looking for a way to test the students on a common benchmark, and so that everyone knows, if I said, you are benchmark 4, everybody will know what that means, what you can do with the language. So we're looking for languages that are for specific purposes as well. You get the kids to a critical mass, which is about benchmark 4. That's a baseline. And then you move them into areas where they will have courses or units on education, language for education, language for business, language for technology and science, language for tourism and hotel restaurant business, language for agriculture, language for social services. Now, you know, the man who supervises the work crew, and the reality in our country is the many times that work crew does not speak English as a first language. The man who supervises those workers needs to be able to speak their language. The social worker who receives these workers and helps them out and deals with things is going to have to speak the language at a certain level. Healthcare issues are vital. I personally was getting my flu shot, and this lady who was Vietnamese came in and she couldn't read the sign-off sheet. Are you allergic to eggs? Have you ever had a reaction to a flu shot? She didn't know what the woman was asking her, but she heard everybody else saying no, no, and she said no and received her flu shot. Well, you know, we need a workforce in which maybe it's not the social worker, but maybe there's somebody who is the nurse or a secretary who has taken any second language. And so in a big facility, let's say for like Kaiser, you might have virtually every language that is spoken in the Portland area covered so that someone can come forward and help these people. Of course, we know in the law business, you know, that you really need to be able to give people a fair shake. You know, if they've only been here a year and a half, and it takes 5 to 7 years living in the community to become what they call functionally proficient, maybe they're not going to know what to answer. So, again, the work is there. We have had personnel directors tell us that it costs them a lot of money when they cannot go deal with problems that happen on the job site, that they don't have personnel directors, human resource department that can deal with issues that come up, and retraining new workers costs them a lot of money. And so industry is also looking for people who are highly trained in second language. We are not saying that you should give up polishing the proficiency in English, because we say that they should graduate from high school with a professional level of English that could take them out into the work world. But we're looking for at least one other language at the functional proficiency level, that's benchmark 5 or 6. So all the issues are there, and we want to be able to think ahead and start planning. The road map gives us till 2025. It doesn't all have to be accomplished in 1 year, but we got to start somewhere and keep this ball rolling. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. That was a very comprehensive testimony. Any questions from the committee? I was pleased to hear you say that you're happy with the Department of Education standards. So
yeah, we helped write them.
Okay. Well, that's great. So that was going to be my question to you. Is there anything that you would like the department to change? Obviously not. Or is it more at the state board level or with any other requirement levels? Or we just need to stay focused on the roadmap that will get us to 2025?
Right. And looking at, you know, that somehow we have to find a way not to have either art or language, either music or language, but All of it. We've got to find a way. And, of course, I hate to mention that five-letter word, money, but, you know, that's where we are. You know?
Well, I know. I was a little alarmed about that. And I know, because I'm on the advisory committee, and Ms. Richardson goes on my behalf a lot because I'm busy, but the implementation of the new diploma requirements. And that's a hard choice to make for someone to have to choose not to take a foreign language because they want to take art or career technical education. Those are all important things for people.
Right.
I appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to us about it. And again, Mr. Wilner, it's always a pleasure to see you. And I think we have Mr. Dave Porter who'd like to talk to us. And then we'll move on to our next subject that we have scheduled for today.
Thank you. Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name's Dave Porter. I'm retired. I live in southeast Portland, and I'm an advocate for more Mandarin in the public schools in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
For the K-12 educational system, I propose goals for Oregon that by the year 2015, 5% or more of the Oregon students graduating from high school have studied Mandarin for at least 2 academic years and have spent at least 4 weeks in China. I have written each of you, I think, many times on this topic. I'm not going to read the rest of my testimony, but I am going to cover the major points.
Okay.
I think there are 5 actions you could take coming out of today's hearings. I'm not suggesting in the special session, but in the interim and going into the next session. First one would be, please hold a legislative hearing on economic growth in Asia. The former president of Harvard University, Larry Summers, has called it the most important thing to happen in our lifetime. If you look at page 4 of the testimony I've given to you, I've charted out what could be the relative GDPs of the U.S. and China through the year 2050. It's one scenario. And in that, you'll see that by the year 2040, China could have an economy twice the size of the United States. And by the year 2050, could have an economy three times the size of the United States.
That's because they practically own the United States at this point, don't they?
They certainly own, Lord knows they might by 2050 own it.
I think they just might.
There are just enormous economic dynamics that are working in the world now. China's only part of the picture in Asia. India is growing too, as well as many other countries. So my first the recommendation is I do not believe that the legislature in recent time has held a hearing on the growth and changes that are happening in Asia. I think there's no way you can appreciate the further recommendations, at least their scope and their scale and their urgency, without understanding the challenges that we're facing in Asia. So I highly recommend that the legislature invite in the academic and business experts and get a briefing on what's happening over there so that you will realize the challenge that we are facing. So once you realize those challenges, then you're set to take some of the actions, and what I would recommend would be number 2, you need to start a process to develop more Mandarin programs in Oregon. During last session, there was House Bill 2763, which would have allocated $350,000 to develop curriculum and promote Mandarin around the state. There's now the Oregon Roadmap concept from out of the University of Oregon, which is more generalized effort to promote second languages in Oregon. Either of those would be a useful place to start. My third recommendation, if the next step beyond something to promote it and get something going with the school districts around the state, the Mandarin's a hard language. I have the figures in there from the Defense Department on how many more hours it takes to learn Mandarin compared to say, Spanish to reach a certain level. It takes a lot more. So 2 years in high school is not going to make it in Mandarin. So I think we have to look, if we want to get proficient speakers, that we start as early as we can, which would be kindergarten when you get them in the public system, and try to immerse them as much as possible. And we do have the model, national model, for partial immersion program, half day in Mandarin, half day in English in the Portland School District. What I'm suggesting here is that you take $1.5 million, $300,000 each, and put that out to start 5 more of those around the state. And I would just arbitrarily try to get some geographic distribution by doing one in each congressional district, excuse me. The fourth thing I would recommend you do is to, and I have on the latter pages of my handout there, to develop a program that we could send more high schools to study abroad. There are programs out there that offer full-year educational opportunities in Mexico and in China and other places. I cite a few in there that are cheaper than our per pupil cost in school districts here. So we could save money and send some of our kids overseas to study. We just, I think, need to work through how we would want to do that. And I have some ideas in there, but I certainly haven't thought it all the way through.
Okay.
But I'm not a teacher, not a bureaucrat. And then my fifth point would be, and I'm not suggesting the legislature fund this, I have thought the business community should step up and do this, that we have in Oregon a summer program to send high school students to China. We should try this for a month to China. We should try to send 5%, which is $1,650 each summer. That would cost about $5 million a summer at the current prices. We would send them not to the public schools there, but to a private school, to a language school. They would live with a family. They would learn the culture, talking with people beforehand. They have ideas on how we could structure that for the best for the students. But I think the important thing is to try to get them over there in large numbers. Again, that might sound a little bit ridiculous, but once you think through what's happening and the challenges before us with China, I think future historians will look back, and if we don't do these things at this scale or greater, they're going to wonder where we were and why we missed the boat. And there's some words I close with some quote. I think I saw Representative Richardson come in. I quoted some of our joint words from a proposal we made a year and a half ago to the Oregon business plan. I think on the seriousness of what's before us. It's not a mere curriculum issue. It's an issue of how we're going to meet the challenge of a rising China and some of the other countries in Asia. I hope peacefully. You know, I think we spend trillions on defense systems to see if, for our fears of China and what they might do in the future, we should spend millions right here in Oregon on trying to meet them peacefully. With that, I'll close and thank you for your time and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. And I you have been a frequent writer to me and I think others on this committee, and we do appreciate your commitment. And Representative Richardson is in the back of the room and he's not interested in speaking, but I know that he's worked with you on these issues as well, and I appreciate that you came here today. Any questions from the committee? All right. Well, you've given us some proposals, and I think we have a lot to look forward to in 2009. Thank you. Okay, I think that takes care of our hearing. That's all we had signed up for on the foreign language issue. And I appreciate everyone who came over and thank the department. You must be doing a good job. The folks that teach it believe you're doing a good job, so that's always good to hear. All right, we are going to close our informational hearing on foreign language, and we will open our informational hearing on pre-need trust funds. And that one, I'm going to start out with David Tatman and Lou Savage. You're both here. Okay. I want DCBS to give us an overview. And then I would like to hear from the Musgroves, and then probably finish up with David Coe, Margaret Bowen, and John Brenneman. If someone wants a different order to things, let me know.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me today is David Tatman, who's the Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. You'd asked us to come today to give the committee a little background on the prearranged funeral trust program, which is commonly known as the pre-need program. And what I thought I would do is give you just a little background, and then David would get into a little more of the detail. Prearranged funeral plan providers sell funeral services and merchandise to consumers for future need. Perpetual or endowment care plans are arrangements that consumers can make with cemeteries that agree to undertake the care of grave sites. The cemetery operator is then required to place a portion of the proceeds from the sale of graves in trust to provide maintenance care for the cemetery in future years. Certified providers appoint master trustees to manage prearranged funeral and endowment care trust money. In 2001, the legislature moved authority for certification and examination of pre-need funeral trusts from the Secretary of State's office to DCBS and created a certification process for master trustees. This was intended to help address the perception of increasing financial difficulties in some aspects of the funeral industry and to increase regulation for better consumer protection. As currently structured, both the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board have authority and responsibility for portions of the statutory requirements related to funeral and cemetery industry. DCBS broadly regulates financial activities, and the Mortuary and Cemetery Board focuses more on the services provided by the funeral and cemetery industries. And I'll turn it over to David to give you a little more detail on what's going on right now.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. David Tatman for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. By way of background, that division administers most of the financial programs within the state of Oregon, and as you're probably quite aware, that includes mortgage lending, mortgage bankers, commercial banks, credit unions, and a host of non-depository funding-related businesses, including the pre-need program that Mr. Savage mentioned.
So you've been very busy, Mr. Chapman, this session.
Yes, ma'am.
Mortgage lending, have you?
Yes, ma'am. I have to say, I think everyone in this room probably appreciates that this is one of two things that are probably one of the two most important decisions a person will make in their lifetime. The first one is the one that seems to be taking up much of the Senate and House's time right now, and that is purchasing a home and financing that home. And while that is a very demanding and emotional decision, I think maybe the one involving pre-planning and funeral planning may be even more emotional. We know that when we have people call us with concerns and complaints, there's nothing that is probably more gut-wrenching and emotional for us to receive than somebody who says, we can't find where somebody's ashes are, we can't find the plot we thought my father had purchased, somebody is in the plot that we thought we had purchased, things of that nature, which are just good faith errors. It's nothing done on purpose, but that creates a kind of a emotion that you can't ignore. You just have to have your heart go out to those people. So with that,
Chapman, I can tell you that having been a court reporter for 25 years, I've seen two cemetery cases in Eugene come through the Eugene Bankruptcy Court, cemeteries that have gone bankrupt, and I can tell you the room fills with all kinds of people who are very emotional and very upset because someone isn't buried where they're supposed to be.
Correct.
They're worried about if they're going to be buried next to their loved one and all kinds of things. So your analysis of that as an emotional issue for people is exactly right.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, in fact, I'll probably touch a little bit on one of the two Eugene cases you're referencing as I get a little further into this.
Oh, yeah, and don't forget the one in Medford.
Yes, I think everyone in the room behind me probably could. That actually predates me a little bit, but I know that's the Kern case.
Yeah, and that was a little bit different. They didn't go banco necessarily because of other things. They went banco because they absconded with funds and spent them differently.
Yes.
But he got rightfully punished.
I couldn't agree more, Madam Chair. So, as Mr. Savage pointed out, in 2001, the legislature made the decision to move the oversight of pre-need activity mm-hmm. from the Secretary of State to another agency. I know there were complaints, though, again, what I know is secondhand, about the way that the process was being administered. Some people called it a ministerial process where they would receive reports, check things off, and bank the money. In talking with Mr. Coe, the head of the mortuary board, he told me that the mortuary board was also interested in taking on that oversight, and that's something I'd be happy to discuss with the committee at a later time. But I think there is merit in the consideration of looking at taking two sides of the same coin and keeping it under one agency. There's certainly something to be said for the good government practices and the efficiency and economies of scale. Having said that, though, the decision was made to take it from the Secretary of State and give it to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And that understandably made sense because we oversee banks and we have to oversee trusts. And the money that is taken through these programs is essentially money that's put into trust. And a trust is a very high-level commitment that a trustee will make to the consumer. And they are fiduciaries, as most of you probably realize, means you have a very high standard that you owe to those people. And so it would make sense that we who regulate others of a similar nature would take that responsibility on. At the time we took that responsibility on, we didn't know what we were getting into, but we certainly got up to speed pretty quickly, and we have a one-half full-time equivalency, a 0.5 FTE as it's commonly known, assigned to these responsibilities. And she's responsible for doing a number of things, licensing certified providers, taking the annual reports, examining the issues that they bring to her attention, making sure that the contracts are properly taken care of. Annually, they have to submit $5 for every contract they sell, and that $5 goes into the Consumer Protection Fund. And that fund is set aside money to ensure that should a certified provider go out of business or should they be financially impaired in bankruptcy, if you will, and a person can't get the services that they've already paid for, they have recourse. It's very similar to what you see in the insurance industry, where insurance mm-hmm. companies put money aside, and should an insurance company go out of business, there are other means for the consumer. So that's the concept behind that. Currently, there's about $950,000, which seems like a rather substantial amount of money, but if you realize the amount of money in pre-need funds that is set aside with some of our larger companies, it would just take a company similar to what happened down in Medford to wipe that out in one instance. And so we have over 200 certified providers licensed with us in Oregon. So that fund really is, we hope, will always be sufficient, but it should never be counted on to be there for every contract that's sold in Oregon. And that's not what its purpose is for.
And Mr. Chapman, you said that you only have a half-time FTE, and I see, and I was a little bit astounded by that. A half-time FTE is nothing. And I, looking ahead in the summary that was provided, and you state in there that the staffing level and the funding available does not allow for us to fully review operations or provide extensive consumer protections related to these various funeral cemetery programs.
Madam Chair, that unfortunately, or depending on how you want to characterize it, that is correct. When we took this program on, it was with the understanding from the legislature that we were to provide the general services that I'm starting to outline and that the Department Secretary of State did, but that there would not be a routine examination process. We would not expand beyond that due to the additional time and cost that would take. There was a notion that we would regulate to the level of the funding that we had. And so that has curtailed our ability to address maybe a number of issues. Certainly, the ability to go out and examine 200-plus certified providers, plus the 8 master trustees, as well as the various endowment care cemeteries that are under our charge, would be taxed immediately. A good example would be the one I had referenced earlier, and that is the Sunset Hills Cemetery out of Eugene, mm-hmm. which I'm sure, Madam Chair, you're familiar with, and maybe other members of your committee aren't as familiar, but back in 2002, we received a complaint about the Sunset Hills Cemetery that money was being taken out of trust illegally. And we sent someone down to do a preliminary examination, what we would call a for-cause examination. We had reason to believe there was a problem. We went down. We took a look. And it turned out that of I can't remember the total amount of money that was in trust, but of the money that was in trust, $150,000 of that entrusted money had been illegally taken out of the bank, and the money was sent off to 4 principals back in Texas. So we took what we thought was the appropriate action to do, and that is not sit on our hands and ignore the problem, but step in and stop the process. We took administrative action to take the license away from the company, and ultimately we continued our investigation, prepared what we would deem a criminal referral, and sent it to the federal authorities in Texas and Arkansas to pursue prosecution of those people that ended up with the money. I'm told by some members of the industry that that was the first time they were aware of that somebody in the pre-need side of things had taken that type of action. So it's not that I'm patting ourselves on our back, but I just think that we have taken, really made a good faith effort to try and take our charge seriously and not just go through that checklist mentality. But that certainly strapped us significantly. We went well outside mm-hmm. what a half FTE could do under the circumstances.
Well, and my question then is, you only did that because you got tipped off that something was going on. How are we to know, how are you to know as a regulatory agency, what's going on out there, particularly when we've had a lot of, we've had a condensation, I guess, of in the industry. We've had some major players come in and buy up some of the funeral homes. And so what happens when you transfer ownership from one to the other? At some point, is, I mean, you could have money that had been siphoned off years ago, and as you transfer ownership, how's anybody ever going to know until those people are dead and need the services, and they go and find out there's no money in there?
Madam Chair, I understand your point, and I agree that is very problematic in this industry because of the rapid turnover that we see. We have funeral homes and cemeteries that have been held by the same family for several generations, but the the trend is to move towards for-profit corporations buying and selling properties. It's not unusual for us to see a funeral home or a cemetery change hands two or three times in a decade, and that does seem to be the trend. The challenge for us is to try and balance our responsibility to the consumer versus our responsibility for good governance by the companies involved. And one of the situations we see is that when the companies make a purchase of property, including the pre-need trust contracts, they have some responsibility to make sure that they've done their due diligence. If, in fact, they have been sold a bill of goods, if you will, or defrauded, they have their own recourse. Our goal is to make sure that the consumer, who has, through no fault of their own, put money into Company A, Company A sold it to B, to C, to D, and when it comes time to Company D, there isn't enough money there. Our goal is to try and make sure that consumer is not harmed because those three other companies are no longer around to take their responsibility.
See, it's a little bit different. I mean, mortgage lenders, they sell over and over. Like, you may buy your home under one mortgage lender and live in it for, we've lived in our house 22 years, and I don't know how many times it's changed mortgage lenders. It doesn't impact me. I still pay my bill every month. But on these pre-need trust funds, when you change ownership, no one's watching the dough.
Madam Chair, Lou Savage again. I think you and other members of the committee know that a lot of the work that our agency does involves examinations of various institutions. And I think the policy question for the legislature is what should be the scope of our review and examination of this industry, mm-hmm. assuming that we would continue to do the work, or even if another agency, for example, you know, if it went to the mortuary and cemetery board, what should be the scope of that review? And as you know, it's a resource question,
yeah.
And so really a policy question for the legislature as to what, you know, what that scope should be, and it really is consistent with, you know, with the other work that we do. You know, our resources will dictate how much of a review we can do.
Okay, Senator Hass.
Thank you. I know that the Metro Regional Government up in Portland oversees cemetery land, has some role in cemeteries. Is that? And I know it's not the financial part of this, but what do they do? And are there other local governments who play some role here, right?
Madam Chair and Senator Hass, I will defer to Mr. Coe, who is the head of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, probably has a pretty good working understanding of those roles. I will tell you, though, that we do have some cemeteries that are run by smaller towns, that they do this really as a retain the historical cemetery, and they're responsible for making sure that their funding is in place and they file an annual report with us. But for the most part, we really don't touch on the maintenance of the cemetery unless they're taking money and holding it in trust. But as I say, Mr. Coe probably could answer your question in a few minutes.
Okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's fine.
I'm just real concerned about this because these are funds that are to be held in trust. These folks have a fiduciary responsibility to the people who have paid them this money. And I've just seen this tragedy strike with folks who go to bury their loved one and find out there's no money to do it with, and yet they paid it to somebody at some point in time.
Madam Chair, I agree with you, and I suspect the members of the industry will be able to give you a lot more in that area, but we have heard any number of incidental stories about husband and wife purchasing trust together, all the money is taken out for the first spouse to die, and then there's nothing left for the second spouse. And that, unfortunately, is all too common. What we have seen and what we are seeing is changes in the law, somewhat through the industry's efforts to clean the law up and in conjunction with our efforts. For instance, historically, what has gone on, it's not really apples to apples when you talk about a traditional bank trust versus the type of trust activity that a master trustee could engage in. All too often, you don't have a segregated individual account for everybody who has trusted funds, as you do at a bank. Mm-hmm. You go to a bank, and there's an account, and there's an account record for each person, and that bank account record is closely inspected by state and by the federal government. On the other hand, too often you have the situation where the money is taken in the individual's name and is pooled together into a commonly held an account. And then as interest is earned, is in theory to be allocated to each one of those accounts. Well, unfortunately, there was no obligation until 2007 to maintain that type of accounting statutorily. In 2007, the legislature passed a law that says every year you shall, on the books at least, allocate the earnings of interest that have accumulated for the past year. We think that goes a long ways to making sure the kind of problem you're identifying mm-hmm. won't occur going forward. Now, I can't promise there aren't going to be other problems, but I think my hope is that that means there's a window where there was a problem, but afterwards there won't be. Okay. The rest of my testimony is really to talk about what we do as an agency around this area, to explain that there is a lot of activity that we have to do as an administrative agency, and it eats up a lot of our time. Our ability then to go out and do some of these other things is somewhat restricted. One of the things I've talked with Mr. Coe about is the fact that his agency and our agency tend to have some overlapping jurisdiction, obviously. Many of the people that are licensed as certified providers, that is the people who sell the pre-need products, are also under his jurisdiction in that they work for cemeteries or funeral homes. They routinely go out and do examinations to make sure that standards in terms of standards of care and standards of cleanliness and so forth are being met. Historically, if he saw something that his examiner saw something they felt should be brought to our attention, it would be passed on to us. He tells me that right now that's a concept that's somewhat in flux due to the limitation on their funding and positions. And so, again, an opportunity for good government may be going by the wayside just due to the fact that the two agencies aren't able to get out there and share information like we should be able to.
Mm-hmm. I see here, too, Mr. Tapman, in the program summary that was provided to us, the master trustees are not required to have any kind of surety bond, letter of credit, or FDIC insurance of the funds they hold. Why is that?
Madam Chair, I don't know. It certainly would seem to be a prudent practice, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm a little shocked by that, actually.
They are fiduciaries, and as
they
a fiduciary,
sure are.
They should have that, even if they aren't required to.
That's a real oversight, I think. Has there ever been any discussion about that in the legislature?
Madam Chair, I couldn't answer that. I don't know. Again, maybe Mr. Coe could shed some light on that.
Okay.
He's better versed.
Trustees in bankruptcy court have to have surety bonds.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're handling a lot of money.
And you can be sure that everyone that's a trustee in the commercial banking world has all those things.
Have we ever had any cases of a master trustee absconding with any funds?
Madam Chair, no. Actually, it's a relatively new concept. It came into existence at the same time that
okay.
they transferred the authority to us. And it was an attempt to take some of that responsibility or at least concern for the certified providers handling funds. In fact, certified providers are not required to use master trustees. They have an option of going through a bank and using a bank's trust program, and some do. But
the banks have bonding.
Yes, they do.
They're covered by FDIC.
Yes, they do.
So I'm having some trouble with that one, so we'll ask Mr. Coe maybe to answer my questions. Okay. So, committee, do you have some questions here? I've lived and breathed this for a number of years, so I kind of know what the issue is, and I wanted to bring it forward because you're going to hear from the Musgroves in a few minutes about some problems they've had.
I can tell you're dying to know this.
And you're dying to know that? That's very clever.
These guys have never heard that kind of humor.
I'm sure they haven't, though. I have to tell you, Mark Musgrove.
We thought about throwing a couple of those in there, but we decided
it's not a good idea.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for providing us the overview. And I appreciate your comment that maybe we ought to look at shifting this responsibility out of your jurisdiction into the mortuary board. But I want to hear from them about why that is. But I just certainly don't think a half an FTE is enough to be minding the store. I think you're shaking your head yes.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Mark, are you going to come up by yourself? Are you going to bring anyone? Bringing your right hand, Diane? Okay. Okay, just introduce yourself. Who's going to go first? Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, and Senate Committee members, my name is Mark Musgrove. I'm here with my wife, Diane. We co-own and operate Musgrove Family Mortuary at 1152 Olive Street, Eugene, Oregon. Our funeral home is the oldest continuous family business in Lane County, and it was founded in 1883. I have served as president of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, as president of the National Funeral Directors Association, and was appointed for 2 4-year terms to the Oregon State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and just recently did that just the last 10 years. I just went off the board a couple years ago. In November 2005, we purchased one crematory, three cemeteries, and six funeral homes from SCI Oregon Funeral Service Incorporated. SCI is a multinational funeral home cemetery company that's headquartered in Texas. They are the largest funeral corporation in the world. We purchased these properties from SCI, as I said, in 2005. And then we discovered that there were problems with the trusts and possibly the endowments. Really, I'm here to testify on behalf of over 7,000 Oregon citizens who entrusted their monies with funeral homes and cemeteries in Lane County, and about the serious problems that we found since we purchased the properties. I'd like to refer first to the first thing in the packet is this letter that you'll see to Charles C. Donald, supervising examiner. The letter was sent October 27th, 2006, to the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. This letter was part of a packet that not only listed the different problems that we found with these trusts, but the packet also included actual trusts that we placed in the packet from citizens so that these agencies could see and we could prove that what we were alleging was true. The packets were sent to the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, to the Oregon State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, to our bank, to our master trustee, and to SCI.
So let me stop you there. You have both a bank and a master trustee.
Correct.
You use both?
Our master trustee manages the trust, and the bank invests the trust.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And the bank actually hires the master trustee. It's whatever.
Okay.
Anyway, that's how it works.
All right.
Madam Chair.
That's fine. So the bank is covered under FDIC, but they're only investing the trust.
We deposit the money through the banks, and the master trustee invests the money.
Okay.
Somehow. Or no, administers the trust.
Are you troubled by the fact that a master trustee does not have a surety bond?
I believe they should. Absolutely.
Okay.
I believe that there needs to be checks and balances.
Yeah.
And we have problems. And I'd like to just illustrate a few of the problems that we've found.
Okay.
And then answer your questions. As I refer to this letter, these are some of the problems that we've found. And when we took over the trust, there were almost 7,000 trusts.
that we took over $8 million in trust money. And this is just the funeral homes and cemeteries that we purchased in Eugene, Oregon, over $8 million in trust monies. The first thing we found that we have trusts that families come in and to when someone passes away, they come in to fulfill their pre-arrangement trust, and there is no money in trust. Absolutely no money in trust. We call our master trustee, the account that was sent from SCI, the disc that had all the trust monies. There's just no trust. There's no Jane Smith. Senator Walker's come in with her husband, made pre-arrangements. We have actual records that the family has paid in our records and our files, and we call, and there's no money there. The money was either never trusted, or the money was taken from the trust at some point. An example of that, if you look in your file next, is where's my file? If you'll look under examples of non-existent trust, okay, on that form.
Random examples of non-existent trust.
The reason I said random examples, Madam Chair, is because this is just random examples from one of our facilities. We have dozens of these that there are no money in trust.
Oh, you have the Annabelle and Albert Kitzhaber is number two on
that. That's correct. The first one listed is Donald Brinkman. The Brinkman family, this is a list of the payments that we have that the cemetery has received for payment for services and merchandise. So it has a list of payments that they've made. The payment started in 1973. Okay? The family paid $842.50, and the family came in, the Mr. Brinkman passed away, the family came in, and our master trustee had no record of trust monies. It's just the trust is missing. Trust monies are gone.
And is this, Mr. Musgrove, is this an account that you purchased from SCI?
Let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
I don't own these trust monies. These trust monies are not my money. If it were, I could take that $8 million and I could go to South America or whatever I wanted to do. These monies are held in trust for Oregon families. They're not my money until or unless I provide services and present a death certificate to receive those monies. Those monies are held in trust for Mr. and Mrs. Oregon, these old people that have put these monies aside, and people have taken monies. The law requires that they put those monies aside.
Since 1973, those
exactly.
folks have been putting money
or
in.
Or 56. We have records, people who have held money for 40, 50 years.
Right, okay. But these aren't people that you had sold accounts to. These were someone else had sold them accounts.
Absolutely.
And so when you purchased the company.
When I purchased the company.
All those come with it. All those trusts come with it.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I purchased assets.
All right.
Okay, which means I purchased the property, the buildings, the equipment. Okay. I also agreed to in on our agreement, they gave us this disc of trusts. Okay. I agreed to provide services and merchandise for that disc that held the trust. That was my agreement with SCI.
Okay.
We did some due diligence on the disc, not good due diligence. This Mr. Brinkman, he's not on that disc. I didn't. My contract with SCI, I didn't agree to provide monies for trusts that weren't on this disc. Even though there might be a file in the cemetery and they paid money, that family was not on this disc.
So then who's responsible for covering Mr. Brinkman?
That's a great question. We have a fund set up in Oregon. My answer to that is the people that stole the money is responsible to repay those monies. That's my answer to that.
And then how do we know who stole the money?
That's a good question. That's the crux of what we're trying to get to. I've been working on this for 2 years, and we haven't. I don't feel we've gotten dramatically closer to answering those questions. I'm asking for help, and that's what I'm here to do.
Right.
Ask for help. Let me just go through some of the other things that this letter illustrates. And the second thing is funeral homes, funeral and cemetery trusts combined. In some of these instances, they combine these cemetery trusts and funeral home trusts. When I do a funeral trust, I'm required to put 90% in trusts. Okay? If a family cancels that trust, I have to give them 100% back plus interest. Okay? So if they cancel the trust, I'm supposed to give them 100% back what they paid, including the 10% that was taken earlier, plus interest. On a cemetery, the cemetery is required to put 90% of services and away in trust, and 66 2/3% of merchandise away in trust. However, the family cancels, they're supposed to get those monies back that they paid, original amount they paid, plus unearned interest in the account. What's happened is, on many of these accounts, these funeral home and cemetery trusts were combined. If you combine a trust, it becomes a funeral trust. I'm a funeral home. If I sell a trust and I sell, quote, cemetery-type merchandise or services, I have to trust it at 90%. And so they weren't trusting it at the proper amount. The trustable amount wasn't correct. They were taking 33 1/3% of the merchandise for cemetery. They were taking too much money out of the trust and not calculating it correctly. Under this commingled trust on number C, if you look at number C, that the good example of that is Albert and Annabelle Kitzhoffer. If you recognize that name, that's right. That's our governor's parents. This is an example of a commingled trust. They commingled Mr. and Mrs. Kitzhoffer's trust together. Okay? When Annabelle died in...
last year.
She died in 05. She died in 05. They took all the trust monies. SCI took all the trust monies when she died, which included trust monies for him. So when he passed away, in June 2006, no monies in the trust. There was no money left in the trust because SCI had taken all the monies. They had taken her money and his money. So there's no money in the trust to provide services. So we provided those services at no cost. Our attorney says that we're not obligated to do that because there was no trust listed on the disc. Okay? That's not our obligation. We have been providing these services to these families for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we are not obligated to do that. Our attorney says that. In fact, he says that if we do this and it's not our obligation, we may have trouble getting those monies back. Okay? SCI is still a corporation in Oregon. Okay, they're selling off their properties quick, but they still hold properties in Oregon. And if we can prove that they took those monies, I believe that they should return those monies to trust. Or if they were obligated to pay those monies, they should pay those monies back to these trusts. They stole those monies. Okay.
That's your allegation.
That's my. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's true.
I work in a courtroom.
I'm sorry.
They allegedly stole the money.
Okay. No, the money was taken. The money was. From our records show, the money was taken from the trust.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not alleging anybody stole the money.
Okay. The money's just not where it's supposed to be.
Money's not in the trust.
All right.
Can I ask a question, Madam Chair?
Yes, you may.
About that. On the accusations that you have made on that is if that evidence seems to be prima facie, what you know that this happened, isn't there a way in which a court could take control of those assets at least temporarily or freeze what you're talking about? You say they're still dispensing of some assets in the state very quickly. Couldn't there be some type of stop order that a court could do until it investigated what was going on?
That's a question for an attorney or for a judge or for somebody other than me. It seems reasonable that could happen, but I don't know.
I mean, I mean, there's been other situations with cases like this where, you know, the court will come in and say, you know, I'm taking control of this until I sort this out. And if there seems to be a strong case of that, you would think somebody would be in court right now saying, hey, I want some jurisdiction levied over this until we can sort this out.
And you do have legal counsel, do you not, Mr. Musgrove?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Some of the other issues are the state of Oregon has, it appeared that SCI was taking a $95 processing fee on every time that they sold a cemetery property or service, and the $95 fees were not trusted. Mm-hmm. And the state did come out just last year with a when we sent them a question, and they said that yes, upon receiving anything of value under a prearranged sales contract or pre-construction sales contract, the certified provider who sold the contract shall deposit 90% of the guaranteed contract and 100% of the non-guaranteed contract. So those monies were supposed to be trusted, and they had dozens of cemeteries and funeral homes in the state of Oregon, and those fees should be returned to the trust if they were taken. Some of the other things that have happened, we have found that SCI made some mistakes in their calculations. Some of the employees, through one of our employees, we were informed that some of the employees made mistakes in delivering items. When somebody pays us money, if I deliver those items, I'm allowed to take those funds. Okay? If somebody purchases a grave marker and I place the grave marker at the cemetery with a name on it, I've delivered that item. However, some of these delivered items aren't placed at the cemetery. They've made a deal with either the vault company somewhere for a vault that may be a fiberglass vault that you can stack up, or they've made a deal with some of the marker companies that they could store markers back wherever, Texas, wherever, and then they could deliver the items and receive those monies. Now, if they actually stored them somewhere, then that would be one thing. But we see delivered items that aren't stored anywhere. We call the vault company, they're not stored. We call SCI, they're not stored. And we see delivered items that can't be stored, that should have been trusted, like opening and closing of graves or some of those kinds of things, that they're not delivered items. They're just, how do you deliver before somebody dies, opening and closing of the grave? You can't deliver those kinds of things. So, and we have found just at one of our cemeteries over $103,000 in delivered items for things that people haven't passed away yet. These items have, quote, been delivered, and the items are nowhere to be found. I mean, they're not, we don't have them on our cemetery property. We've called, that nobody has these items. So these monies were SCI had access to manipulating these trusts. They could deliver items, take monies, change account numbers, take interests, do different things. They had access to these funds and were able to manipulate these funds in different ways.
Yes, Senator Hess.
Just curious on what happens when the money is never claimed. The family has forgotten about it or died, done something differently, and this money just sits here.
Is somebody, or if they move to Alaska, those monies just stay in trust, as far as I know, forever, unless somebody claims those monies. So there may be across the country millions of dollars of unclaimed trust monies just sitting in accounts.
Shouldn't there be some sort of like reversion to the common school fund or something like
we have? We have an unclaimed property division with the Department of State Lands. You don't have to turn over those trust funds if they're never claimed.
How do you determine whether they're never claimed?
That's right, because they could still be alive.
I mean, if they're 200 years old, you know that somebody's probably dead. But how do you know? You know, we're talking. You know, we have six or seven or eight. We have tens of thousands of across the country, millions possibly of trusts. And how do you know that the person is alive or dead?
It's true.
You don't know that. One other issue I would just like to discuss is the issue of interest. If you'll turn to, I'm going to be speaking about interest earnings discrepancies.
So the ORSs? No. Oh, right here. Big, long one.
Interest earnings discrepancies.
Okay.
Okay. This is just an example of 35 of our accounts at Lay Memorial Gardens, Lay Memorial Gardens Cemetery, of some of the issues with interest. Let's just start with Paul Wilson. Paul Wilson, if you'll go across, you'll see that he passed away in 2007. But the actual money was paid. Trust was started in 1964. Okay, it was paid in full in 1965. He made payments. The total contractor's amount was $445. The trustable amount was $50. The reason the trustable amount was only $50 is because part of those $445 was cemetery property or the right to bury, and that is delivered once the family pays that. You give them a deed, and those are delivered items. The cemetery can take those monies because it's a delivered item. Okay, so that $50 was probably a vault the family purchased for future use, and they took the 33 1/3% or whatever, and $50 the trustable amount. They $50.25. They actually put away $50. They didn't put away the extra 25 cents. Up until we purchased the property in 2005, the interest made on that $50 was $4.57 over a 41-year period.
From 1964
to 2005. The interest recorded
was $4.57,
or a yearly interest of 0.21, a quarter of a percent a year over those years.
Oh, that's a crock.
if you look next to this, we took over the account on November 15th, 2005. In the 2 years and 1 month that we've had the account, we have made $4.21 in interest that was put back into the account. So over 48 years and 8 months, it made $4.57. In the 2 years that we have had the account, it's made $4.21. Our conclusion is, somebody's taking the interest.
Okay.
And the law was changed. If you look at what's connected to this, mm-hmm. House Bill 2371, if you look at page 2 that's highlighted, the law for, I think, the last at least 20 years, if you'll see number A that's highlighted, was that the funeral home or cemetery was only allowed to take 25% per year of the earnings, of the total earnings. So they couldn't get into they couldn't take all the earnings. So what they're saying is you add that this 0.21% was supposed to be taken out of the earnings for the last 20 some years. Now the law was changed to say that they can get into the corpus of the trust if there's no earnings, so that they can administer the account.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but before that, for the last at least 20 years that I know of, the interest, they couldn't get into the corpus. They could only take 25% of the total earnings.
Okay.
Okay. So this shows that that wasn't happening. Okay. Our estimate, just on that number one, we did, our bank, Summit Bank, did a very conservative estimate on what the interest should have been with the conservative investments that the trusts have to abide by. They estimated that there should have been $471 at least in that account. And we received $58.78. So that's just one example of the interest problems. If you look at just this list of 35 names, and I said we have 6,800 trusts, this list of 35 names, the difference in what should have been in the account, we believe, and what is in the account, is over $24,000. Okay. Madam Chairman, we have spent the last 2 years providing services that our agreement, our attorney says our agreement is not, we're not required to do. Looking at our records, we probably provided over $300,000 or $400,000 in services to families of Eugene Springfield out of our own pocket, of services that, of things that we didn't have to provide because of interest lost, because of no monies in the accounts. We can't continue to do that. We can't survive and continue to do that. On the advice of our attorney, we will obviously any account that we're obligated to provide, we're going to absolutely do that by contract. But we have to consider the welfare of our own business and services that we don't have to provide. We're going to have to consider not doing that anymore. There's going to be a firestorm in Eugene Springfield. Because people will come to our funeral home or cemeteries and ask us to provide services that they're already paid for, and there's no money to provide that. And if I'm not obligated to provide it, then I can't afford to do that. And so they're either going to have to pay again, or we're going to have to work through the system somehow to find monies to replenish these accounts for monies that were stolen. We've been working with the state of Oregon, the DCBS, and the Oregon State Mortuary and Cemetery Board on this for over 2 years. I know it takes a long time to figure out things, to get things done. The DCBS was in our office looking at records for the first time 2 weeks ago, and we told them about this over 2 years ago. There is a disconnect, and I even see a little disconnect between how everybody understands this and how we perceive this. Let me just read you a couple of emails, and then I'll be happy to answer questions about things. First of all, before we were talking about getting together and looking at this issue, we got a letter from Sarah Hackett from the DCBS, and part of the email said, "It is important to recognize that the DFCS wants to help the parties to the sales contract address and resolve the dispute about that what funds are or are not still owed. At this stage, DFCS wants the two parties engaged in working toward the resolution together." I have to go back and say, wants the two parties engaged in working toward a resolution together. The two parties, she's talking about the Musgroves and SCI. "We do not see ourselves as the final arbitrators at this time. In the spirit of working to resolution, we think it's important to have both parties participate in review. Both parties participate in the review. Preliminary comments from both sides suggest that neither side, has had a chance to review all relevant documents. Our attorney Our attorney responded, "We will certainly appreciate the DCBS involvement in this matter. I do not believe that your characterization of this sales contract dispute between two parties is accurate or reflective of the harm that has been done to Oregon consumers. This is a situation where over 6,000 consumers have prepaid for funeral and cemetery goods and services. Oregon law states that a designated portion of those prepaid funds must be set aside in trust. The trusting law is not set up to protect the Musgroves or any other funeral home or cemetery. It was established to protect the consumer. Despite those laws, we know that a significant portion of the funds that Oregon law requires to be placed into trust has instead been misappropriated. We do not view DCBS as an arbitrator between two disputing parties. We believe the role of the DCBS is to enforce Oregon's laws and to mandate that if funds are missing, which we know to be the case, that the wrongdoers are compelled to replace the consumer funds they have stolen. This situation is no different than if a former bank owner has embezzled those accounts or an insurance company has made off with state-required reserves. Certainly, in those situations, the DCBS and other Oregon agencies do not serve as arbitrators. Instead, they enforce the law against the wrongdoers and compel restitution on behalf of Oregon consumers. This is not a contract dispute between two private parties. This is an investigation into widespread theft of prepaid funds that will adversely impact up to 6,000 pre-need consumers. They are the real parties in this situation, and they need DCBS to protect their rights. If I have misstated your role, please let me know." And signed, Scott Gilligan. After this email was sent, just this last week, just before this hearing, we received this email. After they visited our funeral home 2 weeks ago, "We hoped our visit demonstrated the department's good faith efforts to review the Musgrove files. Even with the SCI staff, they couldn't attend because of medical issues. However, they have thousands and thousands of employees." It's been 2 years. I noted that. "We have asked Diane for several more pieces of information." This is what was added. Our staff are very busy with mortgage lending issues during the special legislative session and now by Wednesday's public hearing with Senator Walker." I don't know how long it takes the system to work, but we've been working on this for 2 years. We're obviously upset. We're frustrated with how things are going, with the speed that things are going, and we can't stress more that this is not an issue. It is an issue between Musgroves and SCI because I have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to repay these trusts that have been stolen already the last 2 years. But if Senator Walker and her husband have made prearrangements with me, those monies are not my monies. They're put in trust. If you pass away in Texas, or if you cancel your account, there's the interest over 40-some years is $4.50. That's the money you get back. You should get back close to $500. You're going to get back from that account the original money that was trustable, the $50 plus the $8 in interest. And four of those dollars, of the $8 in interest, we've made in the last 2 years. We implore the state agencies to make this a priority. We think, possibly in Eugene, that the missing funds may total over $1 million just in Eugene. The FCI and other corporations have multiple funeral homes and cemeteries around the state and around the country and around the world. We think that there needs to be better oversight. We think that we do have laws on the books that and penalties. If you look at the last page of information I've given you, it shows you standards of practice. If you look at standard of practice, it says that every licensee must comply with the Oregon Revised Statutes relating to death care. It says that they need to follow through upon agreed upon arrangements by designated responsible parties. I'm reading from ORS 830.030.090. It says they have to report through proper channels facts known regarding the incompetent, unethical, unsafe, or illegal practices of any death care licensee. So that means that I am breaking the law if I don't report this. As far as I know, this is the first time in 50 years of holding these trusts or more, anybody's reported it. And I know for a fact that former owners of these funeral homes and cemeteries knew of these trust problems, because if they had any death, they would know that there weren't monies in trust. It also says that we have to conduct communication and record keeping, that we can't falsify clients' service cemetery or cemetery records, that they can't alter cemetery records or funeral records, aiding, abetting, or assisting an individual to violate any laws. That means not reporting theft or misappropriation of funds. Those are mortuary and cemetery board rules and regulations that they can enforce. The DCBS can enforce other rules. They can compel an audit. That's what we're asking for, a full audit of these accounts. They can compel an audit, and we believe they can compel the people that had those trusts at that time to pay for the audit. We're giving you this information and asking you for help in helping us with these problems, helping us and 7,000 Oregon citizens to restore the monies to their trusts. And as I said, they're not our trusts. We didn't buy these trusts. We bought the funeral homes and cemeteries and found these trust issues.
Thank you, Mr. Musgrove. Any questions from the committee? Our committee closes at 5:30, but I'm going to hold it open until 5:45 so we can hear from the other three. If any of the committee needs to go because you have obligations, that's fine. I appreciate that you've brought these issues forward. I want to hear from... you have to be in Portland. Okay, great. I want to hear from the mortuary board. And we've already heard from DCBS. We're not going to hear from them again. And I'm not sure where we're going to go with this, Mr. Musgrove, but I appreciate that you've brought this to our attention.
Thank you for hearing us. Appreciate you.
David Coe, Margaret Bowen, and John Brenneman. I'm going to have all three of you come up. Is Margaret gone or not here?
Not here.
She never came. Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify then?
Can I have Scott Nancy come up, who operates our master trust?
Yeah. That way you can answer why they don't have any surety bonds.
Just unplug something, I think.
Hopefully it's my microphone.
That's probably
okay.
Fine.
All right. We've got 15 minutes, no more. We could do less. But Mr. Coe, why don't you start? Because you're the current... say who you are and what you do on the record. I know what you do, but you say it yourself.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is David Coe. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I didn't come with any prepared testimony. I came to offer my perspective with regard to the board's role, and I'd like to start out by saying that I pretty much... endorse and confirm the things that you heard from Mr. Musgrove, and I'd like to say that his interest in this area of regulation predates by a number of years his purchase of these facilities from SCI and the problems that he's confronting personally. Chair Walker will remember that Mr. Musgrove was among those who went and testified at David Kern's sentencing hearing, and he was a member of the board when that fiasco took place and has always been a strong proponent of pre-need regulation long before he bought these facilities and confronted issues with his own business. With respect to the regulatory side, the board has any number of generic rules and regulations that pertain to funeral service. Some of those could certainly be applied to pre-need violations. The problem is that when you have another agency that has not a generic jurisdiction but a specific charge with regard to the regulation of a specific area of the law, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the agency that has the generic responsibility that might bootstrap itself in a sense into some jurisdiction or control to jump over the agency that has the specific regulatory authority. And I'll give you an example. Mr. Musgrove quoted a number of the board's rules, but the board has a statute that provides that the board may sanction a licensee for fraudulent and dishonest conduct bearing a demonstrable relationship to funeral or cemetery practice. Obviously, the theft of funeral and cemetery pre-need trust funds is a demonstrable relationship, and in the event for instance, a district attorney or a court or DCBS was to take some sort of action against a pre-need provider, and that pre-need provider was a cemetery or a funeral home, on the strength of that, the board could revoke that license from the person who was convicted of those sorts of crimes. When it comes to matters like restitution, however, the board has no direct authority to order restitution. The board has authority to sanction licensees that violate its rules and regulations up to $1,000 per violation, and we can revoke or suspend a license. But even when the license is suspended or revoked, the board has no authority to order any form of compensatory damages or restitution. If we discovered a crime, we could refer to the crime to a district attorney, but we don't have any independent authority to force someone who stole pre-need trust funds to make the trust fund whole again. I have heard...
Isn't that a crime?
Senator Cruz, do you want to ask your point?
Yeah. If they've absconded with money that was supposed to be in trust, doesn't that constitute a crime?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I would agree, but as the chair pointed out earlier on, there's speculation as to what happened. Someone has to take the initiative. There has to be the will to investigate and put together the evidence necessary to prove that something is a crime. One of the problems with making a referral to a district attorney nowadays is that the district attorney has what's called prosecutorial discretion, and they may choose to go after a rapist or a murderer as opposed to this sort of white-collar crime. Where the regulatory agency can be influential in that regard is if you go to a district attorney with a comprehensive investigative case file where you've done the legwork, the district attorney is going to be much more likely to prosecute a case when the legwork has been done. The question is who's going to do the legwork and who's going to pay for it.
And we only have one half of an FTE in the regulatory agency.
Well, I may be out of bounds and I may be incorrect, but in reading the statute having to do with a consumer protection trust fund, it seems to me that the director has the discretion to use that $1 million as seed money to perform an examination or an audit, and also to, as Mr. Musgrove noted, the director of DCBS has the authority to charge the certified provider for the cost of the examination. So there is an avenue. I'm not an attorney, and I could be misinterpreting that statute having to do with the Consumer Protection Trust Fund, but it does make reference to using that money not just to make restitutions to consumers who lost money, but to perform the other duties of the director under the chapter that pertains to pre-arrangement trust funds.
That would be news to me. I've not heard that you can use that money for that. Maybe we can ask.
I have the quote in front of me if you'd like me to read it.
Okay.
This has to do with, this is under ORS 97-945 pertaining to the Funeral and Cemetery Consumer Protection Trust Fund. The fund may be used for the payment of actual administrative expenses incurred in administering the fund. All monies in the funeral and cemetery consumer protection trust fund are appropriated continuously to the director for the payment of restitution under this section and the payment of expenses incurred in performing the duties and functions of the director required under this section. So it's there's a multi-purpose avenue available, but an attorney would probably have to.
You know what I'll do is, after you're all done testifying, I'll ask Mr. Savage to come up and explain his impression of that. So let's move on and get the rest of your turn.
Madam Chair, yeah. I'm a member of the Sensitivity Review Committee in DHS that's starting now, and
okay.
I really need to go. I hope we can, that this isn't the end of this. That we,
no, okay. It's not.
This is very troubling,
yeah,
to say the least.
And that's why so. I wanted you all to hear it. So
okay.
We'll finish
this. This is just the two of us now. Can I ask him a question?
Sure.
Because, you know, the board, when you, you know, find a discrepancy, find an issue that may rise to discipline, criminal or civil violations, aren't you required to report that to the Department of Consumer and Business Services or not? I mean, in terms of, you know, your chain of command, who do you need to, because, you know, I chair the business committee, you know, we did this 2005 law, and has the director has certain rights when they have reason to believe they can also entertain the Department of Justice, but as the board, do you have a direct responsibility to be letting, first of all, DCBS know of something that may require not only your disciplinary action, but things that may require additional follow-up or investigation?
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, we don't have a statutory mandate, but we have, I'm sure what myself and the board members would agree, that we have an obligation, and we do make referrals to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and when the board becomes aware of criminal activity, it has been pretty good about making referrals to district attorneys, and even doing so in ways that are less likely to result in the prosecutorial discretion not to do something. We try to present
them. Yeah, but not just, excuse me, Madam Chair, but not just district attorneys. I mean, you have the Department of Justice through DCBS. I mean, I think, you know, and they need to be engaged, especially some of the allegations that we've heard today. You know, this should be in the office of Hardy Myers, because, you know, this could be systemic in this industry. So it's not just going to your local district attorney. You know, you would be going to DCBS. We would be holding DCBS accountable for making sure that they engage the Department of Justice on this issue. And, you know, you're kind of the first, other than the testimony we receive in these committees, you're one of the first stopgap is to engage them and say, hello, we need some additional you know, looking into this particular situation.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, Department of Justice is named specifically in some of the prearrangement trust fund and endowment care cemetery laws, and we have an assistant attorney general at all of our meetings, and when you go back to, for instance, the Kern case, the financial fraud section in the Department of Justice was intimately involved in prosecuting that case. So, yes, and certainly that aspect of the Department of Justice could be involved.
Well, I guess the only thing, and I won't belabor this, but you're obviously aware in great detail, and you've had a relationship because professionally, Mr. Musgrove here, so you've been aware of what he's been discovering. You're saying in your meetings you have an assistant attorney general. I guess part of the thing is, to steal the chair's favorite word, accountability. Somebody has to be accountable to say, gee, is this, you know, who's dropping the ball? Who's not saying, hey, this is something I better start ripping open a little bit and finding out what's going on? You know, is it, it shouldn't have to take a committee hearing and to you folks all to come up to say, gee, maybe there's something more to be looking at here. It sounds like there's a lot of eyes that have seen certain things that may warrant additional investigation or certainly to find out what's happening.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, I couldn't agree more. I think there needs to be some designation of accountability. This has been a hot potato going back a number of years since when it was with the Secretary of State. Now it's with DCBS. I think you heard between the lines that DCBS would like to give it to the board. The board, the industry doesn't want the board to have it. It is not an area that's the oversight is lax, and I'm not sure there is the regulatory will or the legislative will. I don't know what it is to address this problem, but I agree that it is a heart-wrenching thing at times during the case, the current case, where Chair Walker was the court reporter. I went down and attended some of the bankruptcy proceedings, and I sat next to a man and woman who were in their mid-70s, and the man sat on a cushion, and he was watching his watch to give his wife medication. I thought, isn't this sad that these people are worried about their pre-need trust money? And so I pushed a few buttons and identified myself so I could talk to them. And what shocked me was they were not there because of their own prearrangements. They were there because they were concerned that their parents' pre-need trust money had been taken. Their parents must be 100. And here are these are the kids worried about the parents. And it really is. It's an awful problem, and it does need attention. And the board's position is that the primary jurisdiction rests with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We lost a position at the last legislative session, and for the past three legislative sessions, we have come down here looking for a revenue increase and have been turned away every time. So there's an awful lot of there's problems here, and it's one thing for the legislature to make an expression of public policy by writing statutes that are intended to protect people from experiencing this sort of thing. It's an entirely different matter to fund those policy expressions so that agencies can actually do something about it. The only reason I mentioned the Consumer Protection Trust Fund as a potential for seed money is at least it seems like, if not a compromise, a way around the lack of funds to get something started.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Crowe, does that complete your testimony? Thank you, Mr. Brenneman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name is John Brenneman. I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors. Legislatively, I come in here for their behalf for about 10 years. My history with the funeral directors goes back to my first session in 1985. The Almsburg event happened in Lincoln City, right in the heart of my district, and my office rewrote the funeral law at that time, which was quite extensive. So I know the history behind why it was put in both Secretary of State and the expanded Mortuary and Cemetery Board. And that's a lot of old stories that I can sit and talk with you about and give a history at some time. Not tonight. You're getting ready to wrap things up. I have with me, though, Scott Macy, who is a practitioner, a funeral director in McMinnville. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association operate a master trust, and Scott is the president, and I'd really like to have him just take a few seconds to describe the audits we go through on a yearly basis that we perform, and then others. And Scott, you have just a second, and if you have any questions of him and our trust and how we handle it.
Thank you, Mr. Macy. Just identify yourself.
My name is Scott Macy, and I live in McMinnville, Oregon, and I work for Macy and Son Funeral Home. I'm a fourth-generation funeral director. The same family. Last 15 years, or 20 years, I think, I've been on the trust board for the Oregon Funeral Directors Master Trust Program. I just wanted to address a couple things to let you know that we are audited every year by the state. In fact, the state even conducted an additional audit on our master trust, of which we paid for. So I do believe that the director has the authority to do that, to charge for an audit of a master trustee. We are we are, you talk about regulations, I think that, you know, we have four different components in the trust. We have a bank where the money is deposited in. We have an administrator who works the funds between the money manager and the bank. And we also have a board, a volunteer board of funeral directors throughout the state of Oregon that represent and put input into how we fund and operate our trust fund. So I think in the case of the master trustee through the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, that things are in very good shape. I think traditionally when you look at and I think something should be pointed out, the master trustees are really a fairly new phenomena. Since the 30s and 40s, funeral directors have been putting money in trust for people. It generally went into a savings account, and we had a passbook state savings account. We stuck that in the person's file, and then when the person died, we applied that towards the funeral. Then we start guaranteeing funeral trust. And the prearrangement business became significantly more aggressive and attractive to funeral homes. What it does is it guarantees business in the future for them. It guarantees payment. It also provides in the state of Oregon for people to allocate money before they go on state assistance so that their funeral can be paid for. I think in general that the funeral industry through the Oregon Funeral Directors Association has done an excellent job of monitoring these funds and making them safe for people. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Macy, thank you. Can you tell me why it is that master trustees don't have a bond when anyone else that I know of in the state who has a fiduciary responsibility for money has to have a bond?
We are insured as an agency, and each funeral home certainly has liability insurances, but not a bonding capability. The only, to my knowledge, the only time you need a bond is when you pre-construct like a mausoleum or something of that sort, and you have to be bonded for that process for the state.
Are you responsible for any amount of money? Does money pass through your hands? Do you have control over any money as a master trustee? That's really my question.
As a master trustee, absolutely.
Well, then that's why I'm asking why you don't have a bond. What if you as a master trustee, I'm not going to assume you would do this, but
sure.
Let's assume a master trustee, not you, a master trustee takes all the money and goes to Hawaii. That's the favorite place for people to go, but they take all the money. Where does the consumer have redress? Because there's no bond on the master trustee and the money's gone, correct?
Well, the consumer, I'm assuming, would have recourse through the individual funeral homes if the money was not there. If the master trustee just disappeared and all of a sudden you went to the office and nobody was there, the funeral home is still responsible. The contract, a prearranged funeral contract, is between the funeral home and the consumer. It's not between the master trustee and the consumer.
Right.
Okay?
So the funeral home gets stuck with the bill if the master trustee takes off. That's somebody's...
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's no...
Absolutely.
I love the word accountability, and every step has to have accountability for the money. And somehow the master trustee is getting off the hook here and not having to be accountable. Now, you can't... I just had a friend who owns a physical therapy business in Eugene. Her bookkeeper of 8 years, who she thought was a friend, was the godmother of her child, ended up stealing $500,000 from her by forging her name on checks and deposits and all kinds of things. My friend had all the faith and trust in the world in this woman, and she stole $500,000. That's my point. You can't rely on people to be honest. You have to assume the worst. You have to prepare for the worst. You're hoping people are honest, but you've got to provide the protections to the consumer. And I think there is a disconnect here where there's no protection provided to somebody, whether it's the consumer or the funeral home. As a funeral home, how would you like it if the master trustee took all the money and you would have to honor all those contracts?
Senator Walker, that's why I'm president of that master trustee.
All
it's
right.
Also why we have funeral directors running the program, that we all have an investment in, and we're, you know.
But you never know when a friend may turn on you. That's my point.
No, that's
my,
true. But
I
we
hate
all,
to admit
we are audited every year. Every bit of interest and every money, all the money going in and out is reported to DBCS every year.
But
can I ask a question about that? So how come SCI got away, assumed that these things were SCI are there, if they're audited every year, then how did that get through?
I cannot answer that.
I think there's an answer in the room, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, the SCI is not...
SCI is not a master trustee.
Well, they're not a master trustee, and they don't use the Oregon Funeral Directors Association as a master trustee. So they have their own master trustee, and a lot of these transactions took place long before those requirements were on the books.
Okay, so we have kind of a discombobulated system, and not everybody's... has to go through the same thing.
That's exactly right. And you could be audited on the 366th day, or, you know, the first day of the new year for the previous year, and then on day two, somebody takes off with the money, and you don't find out about it till the next audit. So I just have problems with that. But that's a discussion for another day. So, Mr. Macy, thank you. When was your funeral home established? You say it's fourth generation?
1903.
Okay, well, the Musgroves beat you out by a few years, but...
Ah,
there you go. All right, thank you. Mr. Savage, I need you to come up, please, and respond to the issue that was raised by Mr. Coe about that particular statute, the fund, the consumer fund. And I'm not going to ask you about the Musgrove case in particular because it's a pending investigation. I asked you to look into it, and you are doing that. So we're going to be general here. But talk to me about the consumer fund that Mr. Coe referenced and whether that can be used for purposes other than reimbursing consumers.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, I've brought David Tapman up as well, who's, as you know, is a Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. If you look at the statute 97.945, it talks about administrative expenses to administer the fund. Our reading of that is that you can't do enforcement out of that fund, because if you did and you had a big case, you would have no fund left.
I mean,
and if in fact the legislature wanted this fund to be used for enforcement purposes, we believe it would have said that. It's just a fund that is used for restitution and not enforcement purposes.
Okay, that's what I thought you would say.
Madam Chair, if I could just echo that. I think what that the description that we heard earlier would be tantamount to what we just heard the Musgroves complaining about. We'd be taking money that's supposed to be set aside specifically to cover people in their time of need and using it for something else. Mm-hmm. And we'd end up depleting the fund pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so...
And there's a fund for trade schools, too, that if a trade schools have to put money into a consumer fund, so when a trade school goes belly up, the students who have outstanding funds can apply to the fund and get reimbursed. And so it's the same kind of thing, and that's why the money is there. Okay. Senator Metzger, do you have any
questions? I just have one really final question. The question regarding the bond. We've been having discussions, as mentioned here a moment ago, about mortgage lending, about increasing bonds for originators. Even though you have different lending institutions, they're the originators. They have a responsibility as well. Do you, from your professional capacity, do you believe that we have a gap in the system that needs to be corrected to make sure that all of those who have access to and responsibility for any of these funds should be properly bonded so that consumers can apply to the proceeds of a bond in the case of misappropriation or fraud?
Madam Chair and Senator Metzger, off as a first blush of time seeing this issue, I believe that's always a good, prudent practice anytime you have somebody in a fiduciary capacity. That means the master trustee should have some type of surety bond that an aggrieved party could go against. Now, the aggrieved party would probably be the funeral home, and arguably they're not the ones that are aggrieved by it, but it's the consumer that's one step removed. I will tell you this, though. If the allegations that we've heard tonight about SCI are accurate, this bond wouldn't have any bearing on it.
No.
Because SCI is a certified provider, and amongst other things, but that bond wouldn't cover them. That bond would only cover the 8 master trustees in Oregon.
But it potentially could cover, because it would, Mr. Musgrove was paying out of his own pocket to provide those services if they were able to collect against the bond, then to provide the services that should have been covered by the monies in the fund that no longer exist, there would still be a benefit to both parties.
I agree. It would depend on how it's written, and as they say, the devil's in the details.
No.
But I think it would be a good step.
Well,
and again, there's only 8.
Yeah, there's probably a number of steps that would need to be done, but that's part of it.
I mean, I'm thinking of a situation a master trustee takes off with the money, and of course, now, this isn't the issue we're talking about today, it's just an issue that came up, so I don't want this to be the focus of the whole hearing, but a master trustee takes off with the money, the funeral home is the one that is aggrieved here, but ultimately the consumer is. The funeral home could go out of business, and then where's the consumer? There's no loop back for the consumer to get any redress for not getting the services that they had agreed to provide.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's when that Consumer Protection Fund comes into play.
Right.
And again, large organization goes out of business, that thing is liquidated.
Yeah. This is a very complicated industry. The monies go here and there and everywhere, and I know the industry has been very good about trying to make things work, but clearly in this situation that the Musgroves have brought to our attention today, there's some big disconnect, and I'm not sure where it is yet. I think this committee will continue to look at this issue, and I want to thank you both for coming and being available, and I want to thank everyone here today for being available. We have gone past our hour, but that's the way it goes sometimes, to do justice to everyone. All right, thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on pre-need trust funds, and we will adjourn the committee. Thank you, Rick, for staying.
Yeah, I'm sorry.